Well, we continue in 2 Samuel. We're in chapter 20 this morning, which means we're getting towards the end of the book. It's been a thrill. I hope it's been a thrill for you to be in this book. I have grown so much, been encouraged so much, caused my heart to need repentance so much because of God speaking to me through this book. I've called this particular sermon the Upside Down Kingdom. The Upside Down Kingdom. Now, I don't know if you grew up on comic books. I did. I remember my dad's mom, my grandmother, she lived in Fowlerville together with her husband, my grandpa. But we would go out there several times a year, and we, you know, it's just about an hour from our house at that time, and we would stay all day, and occasionally I'd get to stay the night. And but if you've ever been to Fowlerville, I don't know why I can't say that all of a sudden, it's your typical kind of up north town. It's got a little, you know, it's got a main cross street there, and it's got little shops and whatnot. And there used to be, there's not anymore, tragically. My sister and I just went through Fowlerville to look at my grandma's old house. There used to be a comic book store there. And my mom, to my great delight, would oftentimes give me a couple of bucks and tell me to walk into town and go buy a comic book. And I would just have such a thrill in doing that. I mean, I was probably 10, I don't know. And you know, there's a little bit of debate in my house and maybe in other houses about who the greatest superhero of all time is. Let me just put an end to that debate. It's Superman, of course. He's my all-time favorite. I would come to expect that as I would open up a Superman comic book that eventually all would be made right in the world because my hero would unite everyone through his great ability to protect the people of Metropolis and cause the enemies to scurry away. Everyone was happy and glad to have Superman watching over them. At one point in the series, you probably don't know this, but at one point in the series, a clone of Superman was made by a super criminal. But it was a bad copy job, this clone. And he was known as Bizarro Superman because in his world, good was bad and bad was good. He didn't act like Superman, just the opposite. Criminals were to be celebrated and good people are the ones that were the real problem in Bizarro world. It was an upside down world. Well, the kingdom of Israel, as we approach chapter 20, and read of what's going on there feels a lot like that. It was a bizarro world, an upside down kingdom, if you will. And it's also a lot like the world that we live in today. We could park here for a minute, couldn't we? So many things in this world are upside down. I wonder what's running through your mind right now. I've got a couple ideas kicking around. Well, let's listen to God speak to us today about what living in this world is like and what it makes us long for. So 2 Samuel chapter 20, we're going to read the whole chapter. Hope you're ready to hear from the Lord today. He speaks through his word. Pay careful attention. Now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite. And he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Then the king said to Amasa, "Call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself." So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him.
And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us." And there went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway. And anyone who came by, seeing him, stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Bethmaachah. And all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Bethmaachah. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen! Tell Joab, come here, that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I'm listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, 'Let them but ask counsel at Abel.' And so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?" Joab answered, "Far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram was in charge of the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, and Sheva was secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests, and Ira the Jairite was also David's priest. This is God's word for us this morning. Well, we saw last week in chapter 19, that David was coming back from exile following God handing him a decisive victory and also handing over Absalom to be killed by Joab. You might expect this chapter to describe an idyllic scene, one not unlike the end of a Superman comic book with Metropolis-like setting. But what we see rather is a dysfunctional state of affairs. What we see here is, friends, an upside-down kingdom. You'll recall that the kingdom under King Saul, way back in 1 Samuel, was a kingdom like the other nations, ruled by one who was about his own glory rather than the Lord's. This is testified to by Samuel, you'll remember. When Samuel confronted Saul and said, "Why do you despise God by not following his word, by rejecting it, rather to do your own thing?" Right? And that was the kingdom under Saul. But God had given the kingdom to a man who was better than Saul. Under David, Israel was a kingdom ruled by God's king, God's man, a man after his own heart, the scriptures tell us. In fact, we learn in 2 Samuel chapter 7, that glorious chapter, that the Lord made a covenant with David, not with Saul, but with David, that a dynasty would be established in him. You remember?
Be reminded of the promise. It's just one verse from the whole chapter. It really deserves to have the whole chapter read. But chapter 7 and verse 16 is God speaking to David with these words. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. However, while that promise would come through David's line, David himself would prove to be just a man. A good man, God's man, a man of faith, but a man who was unable to deliver his people from the curse of sin. And we see this very clearly by his upside-down kingdom as recorded in our text here before us. Here in chapter 20, we will see four ways the kingdom is not as it's supposed to be. As we look to each of them, this truth emerges. Until the true king comes, we live in an upside-down world. Until the true king comes, we live in an upside-down world. That's the theme of our text before us. But we're going to look at four evidences that that theme is indeed true and true from this text. The first one's this. We see in our text the fractured union under King David. You see it there right away in the first two verses of the text. Look just at the first part of verse 2. All the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. This is not what we expect. Friends, remember the context. Absalom's been killed. God has delivered David and his men an incredible victory. 20,000 men who opposed him have been slain on the battlefield. Remember, even the forest that they were fighting in was taking out Israelites so that David might be restored to the throne. And the very first couple of verses here in chapter 20, what do we read? Yet another fracture. As David came back over the Jordan to reassume his reign, his throne in Jerusalem, it looked like the kingdom was heading towards unity and peace. I mean, look back to chapter 19 and verse 40, the second half of the verse there. Just across the page, 19:40. All the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way. I mean, things were looking good. But discord and fracturing began immediately. I mean, and we even saw evidence of it last week. Remember, the final verses of chapter 19 record the petty bickering and infighting between Israel and Judah about who had deserved to have a more prominent place in David's return. But what happened next is shocking. I mean, one rebellion put down just so that another one might take its place. No sooner did Absalom get broomed away, here yet another usurper would arise. Look at verse 1. Now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. We're immediately there supposed to read, somebody like Saul from the tribe of Benjamin. And he blew the trumpet and said, every man to his tents, O Israel. That's at least one of the things he said. But appreciate, friends, the irony of that reversal. In chapter 19 and verse 8, the Israelite troops who had followed Absalom, who had just suffered an incredible defeat, remember, they had ran away, each of them, to their own tents. And many of them there, in their tents, lamented that they had thrown over the good king that God had given them in David. Chapter 19 and verse 9, remember. This was the voice that was being heard in these tents. The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. A great many of them took that to heart and remembered who David was and who he was from God to them. And so they made their way down to the Jordan to welcome David back, only to follow yet another worthless man who set himself up as an alternative to the Lord's anointed. It's incredible. When the Israelites arrived, they argued with the men of Judah that they had 10 shares in the king. Do you remember that in chapter 19, verse 43? We were the ones that should have brought him over the river. You're just two tribes. We're 10. We have 10 shares in David. That's what they said. And now they followed this Sheba who was saying, verse 1, that we have no portion in David.
no inheritance in the son of Jesse. I mean, the irony is too thick here to ignore. They come out of their tents to meet the king at the Jordan, only to follow a guy that says, get back in your tents. They themselves said, we have 10 shares in David, now following a guy that says, we have no share in God's anointed. They'd come out of their tents to go to David, and now they retreated back because a wicked rival had lured them away again. It's shocking, but it shouldn't be. Rebellion is the ancient fruit of sin. When sin first entered into the world, our first parents chose the hiss of the serpent over the life-giving command of their Maker. Throughout redemptive history, God has anointed many men to deliver rebellious people. I mean, Joseph and Moses, countless judges and prophets, and yes, kings. And while divine deliverance and covenant blessings have come through all of them in different shapes and sizes, the cycle of sinful rebellion has been the constant refrain. I just refer you to the book of Judges. The judge is given to Israel to deliver them from their enemies. The people rejoice only to return back to their evil ways and ignore God again. And so this is the shameful, sinful cycle of rebellion in this fallen world. Even God's hand-picked king, to whom the covenant of an eternal kingdom came, couldn't break the curse of sin. This was David. God had selected him above every other man in Israel. And as I just mentioned in chapter 7, had delivered to him this covenant that would be forever, and not even that man could break the curse of sin. David, we have seen well enough, was subject to the curse himself, of course. God's mercy, he was forgiven of despising the Lord through his adultery and his murderous cover-up. Nevertheless, he would also receive the discipline of the Lord for his sin. Chapter 12 and verse 11, through Nathan's lips, I will raise up evil against you. And so we see yet another fractured union again under David's rule, more evil rising up in his camp. Well, friends, this is proof enough that until the true king comes, we live in an upside-down world. No matter how gifted by God one might be, no matter how promising their vision might seem, no leader will be able to straighten out this crooked world we live in. No political leader or parent, no pastor or partner can pull it off. That's not to say that God doesn't bring substantial blessing through people he places in our lives. And it's also not to say that undermining and sabotaging people God gives us is somehow the right way forward because they're not somehow perfect in their ability to deliver us. No, we are to submit to those God places over us so long as they don't lead us into sin, right? Doing so honors God. While we live with flawed leaders and imperfect friends, we need to look to the horizon. For soon, very soon, the true king will come and make all things right, all the things that make our hearts discontent. Friends, that's all going to be straightened out. All the fractured unity in the church, this church, the wider church, it's all going away. Not because somebody among us is going to fix it, but because Jesus is going to. The true king is coming, friends. So cultivate not a complaining spirit, but rather, when you see lack, when you see disunity, friends, cultivate a longing for Jesus' coming. That's one of the ways that we are, that's, I believe, why this chapter is here, that we might see, oh, David, God's man, and look, this is nuts. It's upside down. This is bizarro Superman world. This isn't how it's supposed to be. And you and I live in a world just like that, don't we? Just like that. It's supposed to cause us not to be people that sit around and complain and try to undermine people and say, well, I'm not gonna submit to him or her or whoever's above me or whatever because it's not going exactly as planned, right? We're supposed to
have our hearts long for the one that will bring perfect unity. And he's coming, friends. Be thinking about that. Until he comes, we live in an upside-down world. We see that first in this fractured union that's under David, but we also see it in a widowed harem in verse 3. I'm going to read some of verse 3 there. The king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house, and he shut them up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. If you were to read just that verse alone, I mean, it is nonsensical, isn't it? A harem living like widows. Not because the king's dead. The king's very much alive. He just came back into the city. But a king's harem was one of the ways his strength was built up. We saw that at the beginning of this book. The Lord had blessed David with many children. Chapter 5 speaks of the Lord causing David to become greater and greater in verses 10 and 12. And part of that were the wives that were added to him. Now, yes, David had some difficulty there. He was threatening violation of Deuteronomy's commands not to marry many women, right? But the point remains that chapter 5 speaks about God establishing David's kingdom and making it strong, and he kept increasing and increasing. And one of the ways he was increasing was the royal family was expanding, and that comes through his harem. But his sin had resulted in his son Absalom violating these women who had brought blessing and strength to him. And so instead of them being celebrated members of the royal family now upon David's return, they now lived as if they had no husband, no part in the king, widows until they passed out of this world. And friends, that's not how it was supposed to be. We see the sort of thing in our world too. Relationships ending and spouses being widowed. This is not how it's supposed to be in this world, friends. Adultery and immorality, abuse and abandonment, death and divorce, these are tragically commonplace in this sin-cursed world. It was in David's time, and it is in our time. It's not how it's supposed to be. I was just counseling a friend just a few days ago. His wife has abandoned the faith and divorced him. I can't even tell you the great damage that that has caused him personally, of course, but also many people that know them. Lots of people in this room know of that kind of pain. Still others have lost their spouses and children to death, and no one in this world can prevent it. Not one of us. Even though God gives us, you know, these incredible medical breakthroughs and really smart people, talented scientists and surgeons, and yet nobody can push back the curtain of death that comes. Mourning and loss are regular features of the upside-down world we live in. King David certainly couldn't prevent it, but the Son of David can, friends. The Son of David can make things right. The Son of God is going to, the one who came through the womb of a virgin and experienced suffering and loss and death himself for us, he did this only to defeat the curse of death. He did it. He can. And he's coming back to put a final silence to death. And all of this destructive relationship, all of this abuse, and all of this tragedy. So as you grieve, do so in hope. As you feel the loss that you will experience in this life in so many ways, friends, pray the Spirit will help you develop a deeper yearning for Jesus coming. Because all will be made well upon His return. John tells us of that day in Revelation 21, verses 3 through 4. Listen now. I heard a voice from the throne saying, "Behold,
The dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. That's yet before us. That's what will be the right side up world of being with Jesus when he comes. But that day is still yet to come. Until the true king comes, we live in this upside down world. We see it as King David returns to rule in Jerusalem, only to experience a fractured union and a widowed harem. But we also see it in an insubordinate general. Whew, tough one to get out. In an insubordinate general. That is a disobedient general. A general that was ruling things according to his own purposes. We see that in verses 4 through 15, and again those last few verses at the end of the chapter. Now this is the big bulk of the chapter. I'm going to try to pare it down so that we can kind of follow what it is to see that this world that David's in, right, is upside down, partially because his chief general is doing his own thing, not obeying the king, not protecting the people. David first commands Amasa. Remember, Amasa was the one he made the personal appeal to? Remember, he said, hey, come back. There's going to be place for you in the kingdom. Even though you rebelled against me in the past, I've got a place for you, brother. You're going to rule over my army even. And so he makes good on it. He first commands this Amasa to gather his troops and quickly put down Sheba's rebellion. And instead of him responding quickly to this critical order, verses 4 and 5, Amasa delayed beyond the set time. 3 days you get, and he decided he needed more time. So David moves on to another of his generals. In verse 6, he tells Abishai to pursue Sheba, verse 6, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. Like, time is of the essence. Let's get moving. And we would have expected that he would have first turned to Joab, wouldn't we? I mean, he's the guy that gets things done. But he had also just killed the king's son against the king's wishes, you remember. So that may be why Amasa and then Abishai were called by David first. But what happens next? He Amasa's taking too long. He turns to Abishai. What happens next? More defiance, more personal agendas, more delay. When Amasa finally decides to show up, Joab murders him out of jealousy or anger at his tardiness, or we don't know why. I mean, who knows with Joab, but it is gruesome business, isn't it? Reminiscent of the lawlessness of the time of the judges, Joab stabs Amasa with his left hand and spills out all his entrails. This is scary, similar to Judges 3. And Judges, as I said, was the time there was no king. And this is a time kind of like that. Even though David's back, it's as if he's not back. Things are not running the way they're supposed to run here. Instead of heeding the king's urgent command, every soldier who's now marching out, they're stopping at the sight of Amasa wallowing in his blood in the highway, verse 12. They're supposed to be double timing it to save David's reign a second time from another usurper. And what's going on? His own generals have slowed everything down in every possible way. Now each soldier is stopping going like, wow, I thought that was the guy we were supposed to be following. I guess there's a new general now. The result? Sheba does exactly what David feared. He locks himself up in the fortified city of Abel, verse 14. And that required Joab, who David never called to do anything on this mission in the first place, to lead David's army to try to destroy a city in the promised land filled with faithful people. I mean, this is not how things are supposed to be running. Generals disregarding the king's commands to protect the people. Generals killing other generals. God's people put in harm's way. This is bizarro world. Not a world where God's king is ruling over his people for their blessing. But that's the world we live in, isn't it? That's the world we live in. Powerful people hurting those they are supposed to serve. People in charge endangering those they are charged to protect. Politicians telling us what we want to hear, so we vote for them, and they have no intention of doing the things that would be good for us. And all the while, crime rages, the weak are left to fend for themselves if they can, and personal advancement at the cost of others rules the day. That's the world we live in. Not just insubordinate generals, you just fill in the blank, insubordinate everybody's. Solomon wrote of it. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 1. I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. That's the kingdom in chapter 20, and that's us today in many ways. That might have been written today, right? That word of Solomon. How many oppressions? How many people weak and trampled on and no one to comfort them? Until the true king comes, we live in an upside-down world. David couldn't keep his generals in line. He couldn't keep his people safe because his generals did whatever they wanted to do. In fact, the summary at the end of the chapter doesn't even mention David ruling over Israel. Do something for me. Keep your finger in chapter 20 and flip back to chapter 8. Can you do that? Chapter 8, 2 Samuel 8, look at the end of the chapter. There's, I think, four different summary statements, these little conclusion statements throughout 1 and 2 Samuel. The last one's in chapter 8 and verse 15. Look how it begins. Are you there? So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. And then what follows is all the people under David who held different positions. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, etc. Now look back to our text, verse 23. Here's the start of the summary. Do you see it? Right away you see what's different, right? No mention of David. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel. You see that? Do you know what the author's doing for us here? He's saying, it's like there's no king. Nobody's ruling. Yeah, there are people in different spots, but they're kind of doing whatever they want to do. As we just read. And so it's no surprise we have this conclusion at the end of our chapter like this. I mean, how many times has Joab went off the rails disobeying the king, doing what he thought was best and what was best for himself? And we see that and more today, don't we? Just rebellion among people in authority. I mean, I wonder if you're fearful today. I wonder if you struggle with that. As you look around and you see violence breaking out across our land. I mean, it wasn't just a minute ago, our cities were on fire. I mean, it was like mob rule. It was pretty frightening stuff. And we see crazy world leaders having access to terrible weapons of war. I mean, the Middle East is on fire today. I wonder if self-consumed politicians and authoritarian regimes cause you to despair that peace could ever come. The people in power will ever do what's right and good for the people that they are over. I mean, certainly that must have been going on among the people that were inside the walled city that Joab was about to, you know, batter down. Right? Well, if you struggle with such things, be encouraged today, friends, for the true king is coming. The true king is coming. And when he does, he will set things right. There won't be any powerful people running their own agendas. There won't be anybody that will be insubordinate to Jesus and get away with it. There won't be anyone that is like sort of like hiding their own personal, you know, plans and hurting other people and lining their own pockets when King Jesus comes. Revelation 19 describes the Lord Jesus coming back on a white horse to judge the kings and oppressors in this world. And John's vision speaks of his eyes of fiery judgment in flames and a sharp sword coming from his mouth to cut down the wicked. Here's some of the language, Revelation 19, verse 17. An angel with a loud voice called to all the birds, which is strange. Jesus on his white horse and his fiery eyes and the sword from his mouth is coming again. And the angel almost interrupts the scene to speak to birds. But this is what he says to the birds. Come, gather for the great supper of God to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men. The kind of men that we see operating in David's kingdom. In this text, the sort of people that we see in our own world today. Rest assured, friends, a time of unimaginable peace is coming. Isaiah speaks of what will be the new reality when Christ comes to establish his reign and banishes all the rebels and all the oppressors and all the violence. Isaiah 11, verse 6, it's a well-known, beautiful passage. Let me read a little bit to you. When Jesus comes, this is what it will be like. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. In that day the root of Jesse will come, and of him shall the nations inquire. And his resting place shall be glorious. May you live by faith while you're still in this upside down world waiting for that day. Waiting for that day where Jesus comes and ushers in a reign of justice that will never end. It's a tough chapter to get through, to try to figure out how it stitches together, but are you seeing how they link together? A fractured union, a widowed harem, insubordinate generals, such things mar the world that we live in, but it reflects the cursedness of it. It reflects the fact that there isn't a true king here reigning personally today, but that day is coming. Until then, we live in this upside-down world. And there's one more evidence of it in our text, that things are not as they will be. As David reclaims his throne, we also see a violent peacemaker. We see that in verses 16 through 22. Sheba had hid himself in the walled city of Abel, right? A fortified city. Joab was making plans to knock down its walls. He was building an earthen mound so they could get up to the height of the wall so that they might, I don't know, shoot arrows over it or get men to climb over. And they had a battering ram, and he was making plans to just mow the city down, to level that city and anyone in it who was in the way of him taking out Sheba and his men. The only problem is that Abel was this shining example of what Israel was supposed to be. A mother in Israel, verse 19. A leader among God's covenant people throughout the promised land. It had a reputation of settling disputes, of providing counsel that yielded peace. And doesn't that just sound like a place you'd want to live? We hear one such voice cry out from behind the world, just from behind the walls, one of the citizens of that place. She describes herself in verse 19 as one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. I don't think that's boasting. I think this is, the narrator describes her as a wise woman,
wisdom's used at least two times. It might be three, I can't remember. And if there's a hero in the story, she's it. If there's a hero in this story, this woman is the hero. She speaks like Abigail, who convinced David not to spill her husband's innocent blood back in 1 Samuel. For she convinced Joab not to destroy her city and all the faithful people in it by delivering up the enemy of the king. But even here, we see an indication that the kingdom is upside down. I mean, don't we? For the wise woman of peace saves her city by having Sheba's head separated from his body and chucking it over the wall. Peace through violence. Settling the matter through bloodshed. Now, I'm not saying she did anything wrong. I'm just saying it feels out of place. It feels like the stuff of Bizarro Land. Up is down, decapitation is mediating peace. But one more thing I think we need to just think about as we consider the peace that was brought about by this man's head being lobbed over the wall. It was a fleeting peace. It was a peace for just that time, just that moment in history. In time, Assyria would capture the northern tribes and take them all into exile. And 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 29 includes Abel as one of those cities. That city would be besieged. Those people would be taken out, ripped out of their home, and brought out into exile, never to return. So even the peace that that wise woman brokered that day was a fleeting one. It does, though, point to something greater. Ultimately, peace does come through bloodshed. We are people that know that. Eternal peace comes through bloodshed, through death. But only the death of one in particular, the blood of the Savior, can make it stick, can bring a kind of peace that starts and never stops. Paul wrote to the Colossians about this great truth. It's found in Colossians chapter 1. God was pleased through Christ to reconcile to himself all things, making peace. How? By the blood of his cross. Through Christ's cruel, violent death, sinners can have peace with God that's eternal. That is the fundamental truth of our faith, isn't it? Yet while we wait for him to return, violence continues. Peace easily slips away. But when our Savior returns, we will experience the peace that he's already purchased for us to the full, without interruption. There will be no need to hide behind walls in the heavenly city. I mean, Revelation 21, 25, in fact, says its gates will never be shut. You want to know why? Because there's never going to be an enemy that's going to try to besiege that city. There will be none left. All will be silenced. While Christians are persecuted and see violence day after day in this upside-down world, there is yet a rest that is coming. A rest that will be perfect. That will fill up our souls all the way to the top. Until the true King comes, we live in an upside-down world. It was certainly felt by those who lived in the time of David's return to the throne, with a fractured union, a widowed harem, an insubordinate general, or perhaps generals, and a violent peacemaker. We will continue to experience things that are not as they are supposed to be. In our relationships, in our country, in our church, in our families, in our careers. I mean, you just go on and on. We are going to continue to experience things not as they really should be. But when we do, you know what I'm going to say. I've said it already. When we do, ask God to stir up your affections for Christ. Cause you to long for his return, for that day when he will come and all of these things will be replaced with a rule of righteousness and peace that will never end. Take a few moments of just quiet reflection on this particular word, friends. Let God's truth wash over your soul. How is the Spirit of Christ calling you to change today, to respond to His word today?